Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters. Hello, on June 24th, 1894, President of France Sadie Carnot was stabbed by an anarchist. On September 10th, 1898, Empress Elizabeth of Austria was stabbed by an anarchist. On July 29th, 1900, King Umberto I of Italy was shot by an anarchist. On September 6th, 1901, President of the United States William McKinley was shot by an anarchist. If you have ever wondered why people in the 1900s, right up to the Great War and beyond, all seem to have had anarchists on the brain, those are four of the reasons. But these attention-grabbing acts were far from the first anarchist attacks to capture the public imagination, and nowhere near the most violent or destructive, as my guest today makes clear. From the mid-19th century, the combination of technological and cultural developments in mass media and in weaponry and in the development of the bureaucratic state made acts of violence resonate around the globe. What follows, writes James Crossland in the preface to his new book, is the story of how revolutionaries, thinkers, killers, and spies learned a lesson as heinous as it has proved enduring, resonating with menace into our own troubled age, the means by which to bring terror to the world. James Crossland is professor of international history at Liverpool John Moores University, where he is co-director of the Center for Modern and Contemporary History. His interests are in, among other things, terrorism, propaganda, and the history of international humanitarian law. His third and most recent book is The Rise of the Devils, Fear and the Origins of Modern Terrorism, and is the subject of our conversation today. James, welcome to Historically Thinking.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for that adroit introduction. Excellent.
So where do you begin your story, and why is it unusual to begin a history of anarchism where you do?
Well, I think that for so long, terrorism and the history of it gravitated towards the anarchist wave of the 1890s because it was the form of terrorism that was most recognizable to our contemporary mindset, particularly after 9/11, when we've got a global panic over terrorism, we've got a global threat in Islamic fundamentalism that can manifest everywhere. There were these comparisons made between that type of global threat and the irrationality of the ideology behind it, comparisons between that and the anarchists of the 1890s. And so you get this flood of books really in the aughts and into the 20-teens really that really focus on anarchism, because historians always look at history through a contemporary lens, and the anarchists seem like a good analog for our own times. And when I started work on this book, I started, like most people, with the anarchists, but then I started thinking, well, why is the word terrorism being bandied around in the 1890s? Where did this come from? And I was aware, as most historians of political violence are, that terrorism as a term can really be dated back to the French Revolution, its first use referring to the revolutionary terror, the use of the guillotine by the revolutionaries there who were the government at the time, kind of flips the idea on its head. But what I was curious about was where did this term come from? Where did it evolve? Why was it applied to anarchists especially? And when I was trawling through newspaper coverage of the era, I came across a fantastic headline from 1881 in the New York Times, which called for a war on terrorism. Hmm. So 120-odd years before George W. Bush does the same with slightly altered language. And I thought to myself, well, this is already in the lexicon. People already know what a terrorist is, and they already are using the same kind of verbiage that we use in our time to discuss it. And so I just followed the thread backwards, and I realized that actually from the 1890s going back, you have Irish Republican terrorism in the 1870s and 1880s. You have Russian nihilist terrorism in the 1880s and right back to the 1860s. And eventually going through different forms of political violence in this period, including the Ku Klux Klan in its first iteration, as well as various nationalist movements in Europe, I happened upon what I argue is my starting point for modern terrorism. And that's an attempted regicide slash terrorist attack on the streets of Paris in January 1858 by an Italian nationalist called Felice Orsini.
So it's a fantastic chapter, Three Bombs in Paris, your opening chapter. You have crowds gathered at the Opera House on 14th January, 1858. They're there for William Tell, of all things, an opera about a heroic figure who rebels against a tyrant. And but everyone's waiting for the emperor, who you describe as, I mean, finely mustached, pensive-faced, part cocksure power broker, part insecure melancholic. The Emperor of France, Napoleon III, was a man of frantic contradictions, as fond of melodrama as he was of empty praise. That's a fantastic sentence. I hope you drank a beer after that. Yeah, you deserve it.
I was perhaps inspired by contemporary figures. Let's put it that way.
Maybe. But there's so many of them that yes. kind of reflect that. So Napoleon arrives and at the opera, and then what happens?
Well, it's all revelry. Lots of Viva la Emperor, lots of people gathered, a couple of hundred people gathered around to see him because this is a big event. And then in the midst of all this, when his carriage is pulling up to the opera house and he's got his lancers, he's got his guards, and the crowd are kind of pressing forward to catch a glimpse of him and his wife, suddenly there's this explosion. And it's not just an explosion, there's the smoke that comes with it. There's shrapnel. It becomes quickly apparent. People start falling to the ground. They don't know what's happened, but they're bleeding. They're wounded. The guards themselves are wounded. The horses dragging the carriage, they're dead. The driver is dead. And this again, the suddenness of this. This isn't artillery going off. This isn't a war zone. This is Paris on a cold January evening. People just wanted to go to the theater. And what's happened is three bombs have gone off in the vicinity of the emperor's carriage. They've been thrown by the aforementioned Italian nationalist Felice Orsini and two accomplices. There was a fourth accomplice who had a fourth bomb, but he had an attack of nerves at the last minute and retreated across the road to a cafe and drew a lot of attention to himself by panicking. But three bombs is enough to really solidify this as a terrorist attack, because it does terrify an awful lot of people. It wounds a lot of people.
Wounds 156 casualties.
That is
the die from shrapnel wounds.
Official figures, yeah. You get differences on that, but averaging it out, that's what I've come up with is the most solid figure we have. So that's a lot of damage from three bombs. And the reason why is because of the shrapnel effect of the bombs themselves. It scatters metal across a wide area. There's also a lot of glass.
A lot of glass and a lot of wood splinters from the carriage, too, it seems.
Yes.
Part of your story is the advance of technology. So what's an Orsini bomb? And it's like a glorified mid-career grenade, I guess.
Yeah, it is effectively a hand grenade, but it has a couple of sinister innovations to it. So the Orsini bomb is developed by its namesake as a tool for, and I argue this in Rise of the Devils, it is specifically a terrorist weapon. And that's because he, being Orsini, is ostensibly carrying out a targeted killing of the emperor, but he's using a very ineffective weapon for it. A shrapnel grenade is not something you would use for a targeted killing. You would use a knife, a gun, something like that, poison even. So he's built this bomb to detonate in a crowded area to create maximum fear and damage. And the reason why it will have that effect is because it is a handheld weapon, very easy to move around. It's highly portable. It's reasonably light for what it is. It's basically a big ball of iron, two shells that click together. And the material inside detonates when it hits a hard surface. So that's the other key innovation here. This thing does not require you to light a fuse and grab attention. It doesn't have a timer that might not work. This is an idiot-proof IED. You throw it at a hard surface and it detonates. And that's precisely what happens.
Percussion strikers around the periphery of the bomb or the hemispheres of the bomb. I mean, which makes it dangerous to use in war. I mean, you wouldn't want to trip while you're carrying it up to the front lines. I mean, it's really only useful for a terrorist act.
Yeah, I mean, it does turn up in conflicts later on. It has some use in the American Civil War, for example, and in the various Polish uprisings in the 1860s. So it does turn up, but in a battle scenario, it's not the most stable weapon in the world.
Someone else can carry that one, as far as I'm concerned. What made Napoleon in 1858 a particularly juicy target for an Italian nationalist?
Well, first of all, he's the strong man of Europe. He commands Europe's most powerful army. And that army is used, amongst other things, to add military power to the Pope in Rome, France being a Catholic country. Italy at this time does not exist as a state. It is a geographical expression, as Clemens von Metternich would have it. And it is ruled, the top half of it at least, is ruled by the Emperor of Austria, Franz Joseph. And then the Pope controls Rome. Orsini is one of a generation of Italian nationalists, the same generation as Giuseppe Garibaldi, who's a lot more famous and kind of dashing in many respects. But they're part of this generation of Italian nationalists who have been struggling to unify their country for decades, and they've always floundered on the fact that they don't have standing armies to fight the French army, they don't have standing armies to fight the Austrians. And one of the things that Orsini comes up with is basically a domino effect. If you cut off the head of the snake, he being Napoleon III, the body ebbs away. By killing Napoleon, he believed that he could start this sequence of events whereby the France would be thrown into disarray, which means the Pope no longer has military support, which gives an opening to Italian nationalists for an uprising. He also had a grander ambition that by taking out the strong man of Europe, the big emperor, he would send a message to other nationalist groups across Europe that the time is nigh to strike, and that these emperors are not foolproof. They are not infallible. They are not beyond your reach. And this is where I think the terroristic aspect comes in. Orsini does not have an army. He doesn't have artillery. He doesn't have men at arms, but he does have an innovative IED and men who are willing to die throwing it. And that's a powerful, powerful message in this period. And that's one that he really wanted to convey through this attack.
Now, a feature of this era and really of all terrorist acts and also of counterterrorism is conspiracy. I mean, you have to have a conspiracy in order to get things rolling in a secret operation. Orsini comes from a very fervent generation of conspiracies and secret societies. Could you explain the importance of the Carbonari to Orsini and to this sort of first generation?
So the Carbonari are one of a score of secret societies, as you say, that emerge in Europe in the 19th century. And this is a golden age of secret societies and plotting. And a big part of the reason why is because there is an intense growing animosity between various groups, be they nationalists, be they socialists, be they proto-anarchists, whatever their claim is, and the powers that be, the emperors who control Europe. And so the need to conspire in secrecy against these emperors is paramount. The Carbonari are the preeminent secret society in Italy at this time that's pledged to Italian independence. And one of the things that Orsini does part of his gesture towards the building this bomb and carrying out this attack is that he was trying to tear up the rule book in some ways of what had been done before. He wanted to show his revolutionary brothers that the way forward is not to fight a traditional insurgency or to just keep conspiring, just to keep plotting, just to keep doing small acts. He wanted what we would today call a terrorist spectacular to kick off a wider sequence of events. So that's his legacy in many respects. And he becomes idolized for it, not just within Italy, but across various radical movements across Europe and indeed in the United States. He's held up as an exemplar of how you can strike back against the powers that be.
We'll get to that in just a second. But I wanted to stay on this, the conspiracy, conspiracies and conspiracy mindedness. It strikes me that Orsini's, it's not necessarily his innovation, but call him, he's a preacher of a certain view of society. It's, and you can call it a part of the conspiratorial mindset, but you can see this with people from, well, I mean, Marx has it. That's unfair. But a lot of, Orsini sees things ultimately as really simple. Society is a really simple organization. It doesn't have that many levers. It doesn't have that many switches. You hit this one big button, and then it's everything sort of ripples down after that, as you say, like a domino effect. So this is part of the teaching that all these people in the book, that the anarchists and also the anti-anarchists to a certain extent begin to have, is society is a lot more simple than I think normal historians should believe that it actually is.
Yeah, I mean, that is the essence of conspiracy, as you say, is to simplify things, simple answers to complex questions, boiling things down to a single act that will change the world or turn it on its head in some way, further your political objective. That is a recurring theme throughout Rise of Devils of the various groups I look at, some of whom are conspiring on a national level, like the Cabanari, like the nihilists in Russia, and some of whom have a more international scope. And the counter to this is the, as you say, the police mindset that goes after them, which is, to speak in blanket terms, the police of this era, they see conspiracies everywhere. And they're not entirely unjustified in that. They perhaps put a little bit too much weight on how effective these conspiracies are. But nonetheless, this is an era of a kind of a duel within the shadows, if you like, between the revolutionaries and those who are hunting them.
One thing that's very important for Orsini's message living on after his death is that he succeeds. He doesn't kill Napoleon, but he actually gets what he wants. And that turns out to be very inspiring to people, as we will see in just a second. But could you explain how he got what he wanted?
Well, it's one of these bizarre outcomes where he is captured after the bombing. As you say, he's unsuccessful in killing Napoleon. But he and his conspirators are captured. He, during his imprisonment, allegedly, he sends letters to Napoleon. I say allegedly because there's a school of thought that says that Napoleon actually had these letters doctored up. Because what they amount to is Orsini saying, look, these attacks are going to continue. And I didn't want to kill you, but you basically forced my hand. And it's because the state Italy's in, and you, Emperor, you have the power to change this. And the way you change it is by booting the Emperor of Austria, Franz Josef, out of Italy, and in thereby letting us have a course to independence. And Napoleon basically uses this as an excuse to have a war in Italy against the Emperor of Austria, in which he's victorious. And in doing so, he does kind of leave Italy wide open for what becomes the Italian War of Independence, which is precisely what, as you say, Orsini wanted to happen. Now, it doesn't happen in his lifetime. Orsini is guillotined before he can see this realized. But nonetheless, it does set in train a sequence of events that Orsini would have wanted.
We should mention before we move on also, because important to the story are the various secret policemen, broadly understood, and Napoleon has a very striking figure who actually dies in that war in Italy, doesn't he? But who leads the crackdown for Napoleon III against these terrorists within France.
Yes. So General Espinassi was a what today we would call a counterinsurgency specialist, I guess, and I'm saying that in very loose terms. Yeah. He cut his teeth as a soldier, first in the Crimean War, fighting in the French army, and then doing what you would euphemistically describe as colonial policing in Algeria, which was basically amounted to committing a lot of atrocities against colonial peoples. After the bombing, Espinassi is put in charge of the security response. And it's an interesting parallel to our own times that Napoleon's response is a militaristic one. He puts a military hard man in charge of his police investigation. And what happens as a result is you get mass roundups of innocent people. You get pretty brutal police methods against suspected terrorists, suspected revolutionaries. And you get eventually, as you say, Espinassi going to Italy to fight in that war with Franz Joseph in 1859, during which he's killed when a cannonball hits him. So his end is quite grisly. So he has a short, sharp, and to-the-point career as this sort of hard man looking after Napoleon's interests and trying to guard his realm from terrorists. But he does set a really quite grim precedent for this militaristic overreaction to a terrorist attack, which, as I show in the book, repeats itself in a number of countries in a number of contexts in the years that follow.
Well, you are a professor of international history, and this is a book of international history. And as I was saying to you before we began recording, you really opened up my eyes with connecting Orsini and Orsini's lesson about the violent act, the revolutionary act, and connecting that to John Brown. And it all makes perfect sense, and it even connects to Abraham Lincoln's Cooper Union speech, a passage in it which I never fully understood or appreciated. Could you explain what John Brown learned from Orsini?
So John Brown, if you strip back his motives, which is to free the enslaved, and to a certain extent, do that by inciting an uprising across the South in particular. So he has violent intent with a righteous cause, which is comparable to what Orsini is doing. The violence is there to serve the righteous cause of unifying Italy, and to Orsini's mind, emancipating the Italian people from the overlordship of the Pope and the Emperor of Austria. And Brown and his followers see this in a similar light. They see themselves as being part of this wider global struggle for self-determination for different peoples. Now, there's a racial aspect to it in his case, which isn't necessarily there in Italy, but they're seen as being part of this transnational movement towards self-determination by whatever means necessary. And it's fascinating when I was looking at the connections between the two on either sides of the Atlantic. One of John Brown's raiders actually says, look, this is before the raid on Harper's Ferry, he says, look, these Orsini bombs we've read about in the newspapers, these seem like just the sort of thing we'd need to terrorize our enemies. And he's referring to the garrison at Harper's Ferry. Perhaps even in a more broader sense, he's referring to slavers across the South with whom they want to engage in a wider rebellion. But it's a fascinating use of language and reference to, this guy clearly gets it. He gets what Orsini was setting out to do and what his weapon was meant to achieve. There's an ideological harmony there, but there's also a tactical one, which is, and it's all conveyed at a time when knowledge is being exchanged principally through newspaper coverage, which is very considerable of Orsini in the United States. He resonates widely with the European diaspora there, people who had fled Europe because they wanted freedom from emperors. And these are the same kind of people with whom John Brown and other abolitionists are talking to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you made me do a sort of a semi-deep dive. I started to try to figure out some further connections. The group that supports John Brown is called the Secret Six. It's like a miniature secret society. One of them is Samuel Gridley Howe, less well-known than his wife, Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But Samuel Gridley Howe had fought in the Greek War of Independence. He went there as a doctor and then actually led troops in the battle. Yeah. So he certainly sees himself as a man interested in the international cause of freedom.
Yeah.
And he is certainly, he's a philanthropist, and he is, a pioneering doctor in many ways, but he's also kind of, he's been a hard man, a military man. He's been in battle. So, all those things combine in him in a way that resembles what's going on with Orsini and with Brown and the rest of this sort of movement.
Yeah. And one of Brown's gang at the start basically is a mercenary, British mercenary, who fought with Italian nationalists. And he came over and said, well, you know, tactically we need to do this, tactically we need to do that. And he basically withdrew himself from the plan for the attack on Harper's Ferry because he thought it was tactically unsound. But again, he's part of that same transnational brotherhood, if you like, of people fighting for the emancipation of anyone enslaved in whatever form.
Well, the thing about a revolutionary act is that a lot of people can borrow that tactic or strategy. And so Cipriano Ferrandini is just as liable to be influenced by Felice Orsini as is John Brown. But we know who John Brown is, and we don't know who Cipriano Ferrandini is. So could you enlighten us? Because this is a fantastic, connection.
He's quite a character. Ferrandini is an Italian immigrant to the United States. He is a ardent believer in slavery, and he is very, very upset when Abraham Lincoln becomes president-elect. And he, to your previous point, is a member of a secret society, and they are devoted to maintaining slavery. They're called the Fire Eaters. And he has at a speech in Baltimore, he gets up on the table with this group, and he starts talking about how, you know, I'm gonna kill, I'm willing to lay down my life, you know, to kill Lincoln, and I'll do it in the way that Orsini tried to kill the emperor. So as you say, he turns the whole logic on its head, just as John Brown takes inspiration. John Wilkes Booth makes reference to Orsini, and says this guy had the right idea. He didn't do it right, but he had the right idea because he's, you know, it's sic semper tyrannis. It's that. Napoleon the Third is seen, John Wilkes Booth's eyes, he's no different than what Lincoln becomes during the war. And so it is fascinating how the narrative can be flipped on its head depending on the political ideology behind the person. But this was the universality of Orsini. His story could appeal to anyone who felt that they were either oppressed themselves or somehow standing up for the oppressed.
Yeah, because this is in the air. This is in the political culture now on both sides of the Atlantic. Secret societies, revolutionary violence. And these are like knives lying on the table that anyone can pick up and stab someone with. American historians have for a couple generations spoken about the ways of projecting conspiracies from the North onto the South or from the South onto the North. And your book should expand their view and realize, oh yeah, this is happening everywhere. They're no different than what's going on in Italy. And there's no reason why you can't pick up Orsini if you're a slave owner than if you're an opponent to slavery. It's just as those knives are just lying there in plain view on the table.
That's it.
I should say Lincoln has referred to Orsini in the Cooper Union speech, but more importantly, when Lincoln finally comes to Baltimore, which is where Ferrandini is located, he is protected by another one of these great secret police characters in your book. Could you explain that?
And onto the stage steps Alan Pinkerton. So the founder of the Pinkerton Detective Agency becomes a notorious figure, really, for strike breaking in the 1880s, and also for founding this infamous private detective agency. At this time, this is something that's often forgotten about Pinkerton, who's often damned in the histories as this hitman, basically, for big business later on in the period of the Gilded Age. He's very anti-slavery. He supports Lincoln, and he is – it's one of his agents, allegedly. And I say allegedly because with Pinkerton and accounts of Pinkerton, you always have to – there's a grain of salt there, and you need to have it to hand. But allegedly, one of his agents is in this Fire Eaters meeting, and he's hearing Ferrandini say that we're gonna kill Lincoln when he comes through Baltimore en route to his inauguration. And so Pinkerton tells Lincoln this is going to happen. Lincoln kind of says, well, nah, this is nonsense, da-da-da. Eventually, Pinkerton badges him into taking security measures, which involves Pinkerton's lads kind of guarding the line. They divert the train. In some accounts, Lincoln is dressed up in a sort of disguise which fools no one, because Lincoln has a very distinctive height and gait and look, and you know, it's a complete waste of time. And all of this is done to make sure that he has safe passage through Baltimore and isn't shot when the train stops at the platform, which is allegedly what the plot is, in connivance, incidentally, with Baltimore Police Department, who are pro-slavery and or elements of the police department who are allegedly pro-slavery and are going to help Ferrandini out. So there's this whole plot, and it comes to nothing. But the fact that there's this fear and that Pinkerton taps into it and that he's able to convince the president-elect to take these measures does speak to that climate you mentioned of a secret societies, conspiracies, fear, rising political violence, tension in the air. It's a fissile time.
And you can see how Pinkerton himself, formerly a member of a secret society, mm-hmm. kind of, a chartist, a radical, yes. a political radical from near Glasgow. This is really the thread of his career, isn't it? Because eventually he'll see industrial unions as secret societies that need to mm-hmm. also be penetrated and defanged and broken.
Yeah. I mean, his career as a Chartist is an interesting one because there is a school of thought that says that was a front as well, uh-huh. and that really he was basically infiltrating them to inform, which I can believe anything with Pinkerton.
I would never want to have to work on him because the lies that he told, but then of course the passions that he's exerted on all sorts of other people who've written about him to try to sort the wheat from the chaff is really hard there.
Yeah. He's a recognizable type in this era, though. He's one of a number of figures in this book who really you struggle, well, I struggled at least, to really pin down what exactly is this guy about? What exactly does he believe? Does he believe in anything? Is this just him using the situation, the fear, if it's the fear of terrorism to gain more power as a police chief? Is it a terrorist themselves using the hopes and dreams of young and disaffected to build cults around themselves? There's a lot of grifters in this book. It must mm-hmm. be said.
But speaking of believing in nothing, let's talk about nihilism. But before we do that, we haven't mentioned anarchism yet. And so what separates anarchism from, well, gosh, I mean, is anarchism socialism? If it is, how's it different from, say, Marxist variety? And then if you could describe the marriage between anarchism and nihilism that occurs, guess what, 1860s?
Yeah. So I guess the simplest way to answer the question of anarchism and socialism is that socialism is developed as a theory that will lead to a particular system in at least most forms of socialism. Marx is certainly, he sees a communist future as an inevitability. He believes that there is a natural ebb and flow to the way in which the world has gone up to this point, and that he is living in the 1850s and 1860s at the death's door of capitalism, and that it's going to fall apart and this communist state is going to arise. Where the anarchists differ is in the, not necessarily the outcome, but what it's going to look like. Anarchism is perhaps a broader church in some respects, in that it allows for a number of theories about both why and how existing systems of capital, the state, the church, money, how all that's going to collapse, and then what's going to come after it. Anarchism, in short, is a bit more fluid. And this was a big bone of contention amongst the two premier theorists of this era. The anarchist majordomo is Mikhail Bakunin, Russian theorist, and then there's Marx himself, who is obviously the champion of the socialism and communism. And they have a massive falling out in the 1860s and into the 1870s over a few different things. I mean, they were both very stubborn men who didn't like the idea of one muscling in on the other's patch. But aside from their, I guess, personal animosity, there was an ideological flashpoint for them. And for Bakunin, it was this notion that this had to be organized in some way, that there had to be some kind of, you know, seizing the control of the factories. To Bakunin's mind, it's like, well, why do we need the factory? Why do we need the means of production? That's the problem. You know, just cut it all out, tabula rasa, and we'll figure out what happens next. That was the scope of his revolutionary ambitions, broadly speaking. It's a lot more fluid. And so there is this schism between the anarchists and the socialists of this era, which is not understood really by anyone, any of the police who are monitoring these people. To their mind, they're all revolutionaries. You can use anarchism and socialism and communism interchangeably. They're all dangerous threats to the state, and they all need to be suppressed.
Yeah, I wrote in the margin, it's like a Catholic inquisitor in the 17th century having to make distinctions between a Baptist and a Presbyterian.
Exactly.
Who might hate each other and who are, you know, one's more fluid and it's congregation, the other one has this much stricter view of things and blah, 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 and much bigger theology books. But for the inquisitor, they both look the same.
Yeah.
You know, all of them go to the fire. What's the marriage? What's then nihilism, and how does nihilism come into this? Because Bakunin's the one quote that I could remember from him before I read the book was it the passion for destruction is a creative passion?
Yes.
There's that as well.
So, to explain nihilism and where this fits into the radical canon of the era, nihilism is different to socialism and anarchism in that it is regionally based. It is a Russian ideology. It's born out of the intelligentsia, the narodniki in Russia, the thinkers, the writers, who in the 1840s and 50s start to ponder and sort of put down in writing these notions of what would happen if the Tsar didn't exist, basically. And the implications of that. If you remove the Tsar, you remove everything that emanates from his throne. That's the church, that's the nobility, that's the systems of control that have held Russia together since the time of Ivan the Terrible. This is not a violent movement at the start. This is an intellectual exercise, but it becomes violent in the 1860s when a new generation of Russians, who have many of whom are out of the universities, they've been educated. They're young, they're angry, they want political reforms to come to Russia. Those reforms are not happening quick enough, and some are not happening at all. And so they take this ideology and they take it to its logical extreme. If the idea is a Russia without the Tsar, then how is that going to happen? Well, the Tsar isn't going to just give up power. We don't have elections, so we can't vote him out. So what do? And this is another thread of Orsini here, one of the first nihilist or violent nihilist groups of this period, with the wonderful name of Hell, subtle as a brick to the face. They decide that they are going to emulate Orsini because they've read about him, they know about him. And they actually try to get the blueprints for the Orsini bomb because they intend to use this. Well, they claim they intend to use it. There's a lot of, again, hazy as to how serious these people were. Probably not that serious in the grand scheme of things, but they nonetheless talked a big game about getting an Orsini bomb and using it to, as Lenin would have it, you know, force the pace of history. And that idea, that switch where you take the nihilist creed and you marry it to terroristic violence, that creates a revolutionary tradition in Russia, which continues through the 1870s, 1880s. And it is, as I say, thrown in the same way that socialism and anarchism are by not just police across Europe, but also newspapers. They use these terms interchangeably. A nihilist is an anarchist, an anarchist is a socialist. They're all revolutionaries. They all need to be damned to hell. That becomes a very uniform notion. But in reality, outside of a few nihilist cells that exist in France at this time, that are in this Russian expat community for the most part, nihilism is an exclusively Russian creed. So that's its main difference from anarchism and socialism. The same end goal is there, though, and this is where it links up more closely with anarchism, is that once you take out the Tsar, what is left? It is just the Narod, it is just the people. And they are going to figure it out. They are going to figure out whatever Russia looks like. So again, quite fluid, very ambitious, but geographically confined in a way that anarchism was not.
So let's discuss two events that are key to the, shall we say, the middle phase of anarchism, or the golden age. I don't know. The first, the Paris Commune, and then the successful destruction of Alexander II. Okay. So first, the Paris Commune.
So the Paris Commune is an uprising that occurs in Paris in the wake of the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, which is a war that France loses quite spectacularly. And in the process, in losing to Otto von Bismarck's Prussia, it allows for the creation of the Kaiserreich, of modern Germany as we know it now. So it's a massive success for Germany. It's a crushing defeat for France. Napoleon III is actually captured on the battlefield at Sedan, and that does not end the war. The war continues on, and there's this brutal siege of Paris, where the Prussians, Germans, as they're about to become more collectively known, are pummeling the city with Krupp guns from afar. And that siege eventually, it cannot be withstood, and the France has to capitulate. And during the siege, the so-called Reds of Paris, who again are a disparate lot, you've got some socialists, you've got some anarchists, you've got Jacobins who wish it was the 1790s again, you've got all kinds of folks in there. And the one thing that unites them is that they really don't like the Germans, they really don't like any kind of reactionaries, they don't like their own government, and they want themselves a revolution. And they get a chance for one in the wake of the war because during the siege, they are armed. They are given cannon and they are given rifles to defend Paris. And they refuse to give those weapons back. And in a sequence of events unfolds at Montmartre, which is the most radical district of Paris at the time, which leads to two officers of the French army being shot, being put against the wall and summarily executed by these revolutionaries. The French government then flees Paris in a panic because there is a domino effect across the city, which leads to the outbreak of violence and eventually the declaration of the Paris Commune, which is this revolutionary government that is going to take over Paris. And it's a deliberate allusion to the Commune of the 1790s. So it's a really, you know, really dramatic moment, not just for France, but for Europe, because you've had this geopolitically significant war that has created this new powerful state, Germany. And Europe has barely gotten over that, and you've got this mass insurrection and successful takeover of one of the great cities of Europe. So it's a really significant event. It does not last long. The Commune has only a few weeks really of life in it. It's eventually snuffed out quite brutally by the French army, which is bolstered in its forces, ironically, by prisoners of war who are released by the people who just defeated them, the Germans. But that reflects the wider concern here. Otto von Bismarck, the Chancellor of Germany, who is an arch-reactionary, he sees the danger of the Commune. He fears that if this is successful, there'll be communes in Berlin, there'll be communes in London, there'll be communes in Madrid, there'll be communes in Rome. This will become a continental revolution. And so he agrees to release prisoners to help the French, the French government as was, to crush the Commune. And they do really quite brutally in what became known as the Bloody Week, during which anywhere between, 6,000 at a conservative estimate up to 25,000 communards, suspected or otherwise, are killed.
But this begets then many imaginary communes. This becomes mm-hmm. a fear of what could happen to your kingdom, republic, if the devils get their way.
That's it. The use of the word commune is leapt upon by press, not just in Europe and in the United States, who go, well, the Paris Commune, communists. And the communists, go back to a previous point, the communists, well, they're anarchists, aren't they? And the anarchists, they're nihilists, and the nihilists are socialists, and you know what? They're all in it together. There is this mass conspiracy, all this lot plotted. Karl Marx, perhaps, is at the center of it, pulling the strings. And the reason why the City of Light imploded like this, the reason why these rat bags were able to take control, must be some grand nefarious conspiracy where all these various radical groups are together and they're in on it. That is the line coming out of the conservative press in the wake of the Commune. And it's a terrifying prospect, right?
The sick joke is that a lot of the radicals wish that there was a conspiracy that could pull off.
Yes. And Mikhail Bakunin is a the arch offender of that, because he is, amongst other things, he spends much of his later years of his life in the sort of 60s and into the 1870s inventing conspiracies, many of which are not real, and pretending that he's at the head of these large networks of radicals that exist mostly on paper. So it is an interesting one where you've got, on the one hand, a bit of bluster from the radicals is taken as gospel, yep, by certain reactionary press, politicians, police. And again, we run into this problem of, well, do they legitimately believe that these conspiracies exist, or does it serve their purpose to tell the public that this conspiracy exists? Certainly, a lot of police get a lot of funds released to them in the wake of the Paris Commune. And a lot of politicians are able to ride that wave, conservative politicians, and shore up their positions across Europe by saying, we are doing what we can to protect you from this conspiracy to stop another commune happening. So there are political advantages there, and there's certainly a healthy dose of cynicism, but there's also a legitimate fear, because the commune taps into a long-standing fear in Europe, goes back to the wake of the first French Revolution, in fact, that these people are not done. Even when you think they're done, they are going to come back, and they are going to regroup, and they are going to launch another insurrection. So that idea had it was firmly embedded into the mindset of many police, certainly military figures, political figures across Europe, and it reemerges with a vengeance in the wake of the Commune.
And just 10 years later is an act which I think we've explained the background for it. But from the outside, if you don't understand, it seems absolutely insane that almost 20 years to the day after Alexander II signed promulgated a decree ending serfdom in the Empire of Russia, that he would then be killed by a bunch of bombers, blown to pieces, basically. Even as he was on the act of constitutional reforms that Russia could benefit. He was probably on the brink of constitutional reforms from which Russia could benefit today. Could you describe the assassination of Alexander II and how that sort of further created this sort of second era, second age of terroristic violence?
So Alexander II is the murder of Alexander II is arguably the terrorist spectacular of this period. It's the one that sets off a chain of events and in many ways bookends the era of the commune, the era of fear in the wake of the commune. Alexander II, as you mentioned, was a reformer. He tried to pass various legislative measures to try to modernize Russia in the 1860s. These were not as successful as reformers wanted, and the sluggish progress on reform is a big part of the reason why the aforementioned proto-terrorist groups like Hell and other nihilist groups become more violent in the 1860s. By the time we get to the 1870s, the reforms are still not forthcoming. Indeed, in some respects, Russia's become more repressive because the rise of revolutionary violence and prospects of have gotten sharper, particularly in the wake of the commune. Even though Russia is a long way from Paris, and even though there aren't many Russians involved in the commune, there's still this fear in Russia that this might spread over there. And it's in this context that a new group emerges. And as I argue in the book, this group is arguably the world's first genuine terrorist organization, a nihilist terrorist group called Narodna Volya, or the People's Will. And I say they're the first terrorist group because they are organized in a way that the groups partaking of terroristic violence up until this point have not been. They have their own dedicated bomb maker. They have a leadership strata. They have a cellular structure. They conspire in an effective way through that cellular structure. They have people who produce propaganda for them. And they are very forthcoming in declaring in 1879 that the Tsar is already dead. He just doesn't know it yet. So they understand psychological warfare as well. And that is the signal for the start of a campaign of bombings where they blow up his yacht, they blow up his train, they blow up the dining room in his house in the Winter Palace. They try on multiple occasions to kill the Tsar, and they just can't get their man. And he becomes somewhat convinced that God is watching over him because, you know, God put him on the throne, so why wouldn't he keep him there? That's the logic. And that all changes in March of 1881 when Narodna Volya plant an enormous stack of explosives in a tunnel that they've constructed. Because again, these people are organized. They've tunneled. They've rented a cheese shop in St. Petersburg. They've used the basement of that cheese shop to tunnel under a road that they know the Tsar's carriage goes along quite often when he's off to see the army on parade. And they've planted a bunch of explosives there with the idea of blowing up the road when the carriage rolls over it. Again, God is watching over him, and the Tsar decides he's going to take a different route. But a quick-thinking member of Narodna Volya, one of the leaders, a woman by the name of Sofia Perovskaya, she decides that she is going to take the initiative. She sends two of the members of the group with what are effectively suicide vests. You know, they've got the bombs kind of clutched their chests, says to them, go to this different road where the carriage is and kill the Tsar. And one of them throws his bomb. It lands short, doesn't kill the Tsar. The Tsar gets out of the carriage, and that opens up the opportunity for the second bomber to rush at him in what I think is probably, at least as far as I've been able to find, the world's first documented act of suicide terrorism. This guy rushes at the Tsar. He knows he's going to die, but he's going to take the Tsar with him. And indeed he does. And that terrorist attack provides proof of concept to the generation of revolutionaries, violent revolutionaries, who after the Paris Commune are in a state of despondency because they realize that a mass uprising like they had in Paris was not going to work. Here again, we've got, just like Orsini in 1858, we've got one person with a bomb proving that actually, no, you don't need a mass uprising. You just need to hit your target and hit them effectively. And the Narodna Volya hit their target far more effectively than Orsini did. They actually kill their target and create a pall of terror as a result. They become the Al-Qaeda of their day for a time there. They become globally infamous, the boogeymen under the bed. So that's the first effect of it. And the second effect, just in terms of what it does for the aforementioned conspiracy theory after the Paris Commune, is it confirms to people who suspected, well, these people are more organized than we think, and they are going to strike back. Here they are on the streets of St. Petersburg, killing the Holy Tsar of Russia, no less.
And in terms of practical effects, they get Alexander III, who is Vladimir Putin's favorite czar. I mean, other than Ivan the Fourth, the most reactionary of all modern czars, who made sure to never have a new idea because that might be liberal. Or dangerously radical.
That's right. The revolution that was meant to happen, going back to nihilist ideology, you kill the czar and then everything falls apart and we start again with a new, perhaps democratic, more liberal Russia, that does not happen because czardom does not die with Alexander II.
Spoiler alert.
Never learned. As you say, Alexander III comes to throne and he comes down like a ton of bricks, not just on Narodna Volia, but on anyone who's ever said anything critical of czardom ever.
Read a book.
And he leads a reactionary wave of violence, which is leads to basically Narodna Volia being decimated within a couple of years. The only real, I guess, interesting postscript to that is that one of the victims of the suppression, the violent suppression of Narodna Volia, is Vladimir Lenin's brother, who is a member of the group. And Lenin remembers that and carries that grudge into the next century, which has its own knock-on effects vis-a-vis czardom.
And I think it also relates to Joseph Pilsudski's family. I think his brothers were in prison, but that was another podcast. Joseph Pilsudski, a friend of the show. So the people that I mentioned in the first paragraph were all killed by lone anarchists. And so that kind of contrasts with what we've just described, this careful organization, the planning, the buying of a cheese shop. King Alberto I of Italy was shot by a guy from New Jersey. Well, not really. I mean, an Italian who had immigrated to New Jersey and then went back to Italy, although it makes us very proud in New Jersey, I'm sure. And William McKinley was shot by a guy who just heard a speech by Emma Goldman and thought, man, that sounds like a good idea. I'll try that out. So is this like a different phase of anarchist violence where people are just, this relates very much to sort of the post in the teens, sort of, you can relate this to sort of the Al-Qaeda violence we've seen, the online followers, right?
Yeah.
That they get this idea and they say, oh, that sounds cool. I'll go shoot up a gay nightclub or whatever.
Yeah.
But this is nothing new in a way is what you're saying. These people have gotten some anarchist ideas from somewhere, and then they decide to take matters into their own hands.
Yeah. After 1881, we enter an era of self-radicalization, which, as you say, is eerily familiar to our own. The same dynamics are at play there, where you have emulation, you have people who are susceptible to ideas, dangerous ideas, and that could be because of their circumstances, that could be because they are impoverished, they're down and out, they're angry, they've got a chip on their shoulder about something. Or it could be the opposite. I mean, today there is the profile for terrorists today is a mixed one. You get terrorists from all kinds of backgrounds. And back in the final decades of the 19th century, the same is true. What's different is the mechanism of radicalization. Obviously, there is no internet, there's no television, but there are magazines and periodicals, some of which are incredibly radical, some of which have instructions for how to build bombs in them, that are being shared across the Atlantic, across Europe, being disseminated to certain groups. There's one publication in particular becomes notorious. It's called Freiheit, or Freedom, which is published by a German anarchist by the name of Johann Most. And he is immensely influential, not just in Europe, but in Britain for a time. He lauds the death of Alexander II and says, we should do more of this. That gets him booted out of Britain. And he ends up with your lot, who's given sanctuary in a land of freedom where he can say these things, sets himself up in New York principally and becomes this sort of celebrity anarchist. And he gets immense newspaper coverage. He gives these fiery lectures where he's talking about, you know, kill the bastards with bombs and, you know, just destroy the landowners and destroy the corporations and destroy the kings and destroy anything that resembles authority. And this gets sensationalistic press coverage, and people like Leon Czolgosz, the man you mentioned who goes on to kill President McKinley, people like him, susceptible people, they read this stuff. They read about this charismatic orator, or they go and see them speak and they get inspired and they go off and they do what they think they are being told to do or what they think is right based on what they've read or heard. So this period from the 1880s into really the start of the 1900s, this is an era of intense radicalization or self-radicalization amongst anarchists in particular. And it's because of these information networks that are able to lead to the same kind of dynamics of radicalization that we see today, albeit at a slower pace.
Mm-hmm. You conclude the book with yet another attack on royalty, which seems to be like all the ones I mentioned in the introduction or all the ones that you describe, just another attack on royalty. And it happens in Sarajevo in June 1914. And as you say, coming in the wake of an epoch of assassinations in which the lives of kings, empresses, and presidents have been claimed, the shooting of a royal couple from one of Europe's ruling houses seemed to follow a sad yet familiar pattern. Yet, of course, things turned out differently.
Yes. The assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, 20th June 1914, is obviously the terrorist attack that kicks off the sequence of events that leads to the First World War. And there's two ways to look at this. On the one hand, yes, it is yet another terrorist attack, not unlike others that have happened before. And there's an argument to be made that any one of these attacks in the preceding decades that are on royalty, people like President McKinley, you know, rulers of some description, could have had a domino effect that led to something bigger. But it's the context that's everything here. And the context is that Gavrilo Princip, the man who kills Archduke Franz Ferdinand, he is a young man. He's born of a generation that has grown up in the shadow of the anarchist violence of the 1890s. The crew that he assembles, a group called the members of Young Bosnia, which is basically a separatist group, wants emancipation from the Habsburg rule and its own separate state, Bosnian state. You have these groups that are, they've got the same grievance that Orsini and his people had. And they're driven by the same idea that if you kill this one person, that it will lead to these wider political effects. And it's sobering to think of how many people before Princip thought this, carried these acts out. They never went anywhere, but on this occasion, it happened. It did play out. It did lead to that domino effect.
You write. The assassinations were the apotheosis of terrorism's development since that fateful night in Paris when Orsini threw his bombs. That attack led to the reshaping of Italy and, in the inspiration it gave to radicals across the transatlantic world, forever altered the practice of political violence. The consequences of the Opera House attack paled in comparison, however, to the changes inflicted on the world by the two shots Princip fired.
That's it.
For a while, I mean, you could even make this argument when Osama bin Laden, his videotape message came, you know, after September 11th, 2001, and he was describing the great crimes of 1923. And everyone, most people who speak English were like scratching their heads and wondering, what the hell is he talking about? And talking about the end of the caliphate, which brought about the fall, brought about by the fall of the Ottoman Empire, brought about by Gavrilo Princip. You can see the ways in which these sort of cycles of terroristic violence do drive one another, and sometimes very directly, and sometimes at great distance.
Yeah. Yeah. And these connections can sometimes, I think, be overstated, and you can, you can draw lines from A to K with certain things. And I think with Orsini in particular, I didn't shy away from this in the book. I wanted to make sure that his shadow is cast long over the book, because I think it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that in terms of the domino effect of a lot of these attacks, and this is true for the bomber who killed Alexander II, as I say, that has a knock-on effect of the guy who goes on to lead that revolution that consolidates the aspirations, or at least part of them, of the Narodna Volya later in 1917. That guy's brother is a victim of the repression in response to that. It's interesting to ponder. It opens up a lot of what ifs, and I know historians are not meant to get bogged down in these things too much, but it is fascinating to think about the chain of events when you look at these individual attacks and the wider ripples that they create through our history.
My guest today has been James Crossland. He is the author most recently of The Rise of the Devils: Fear and the Origins of Modern Terrorism. James, thanks so much for being part of Historically Thinking.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks so much to you as well for being a part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, then share it with a friend, or many friends. Vivian Lundy is our assistant producer. John Ruddat is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambone, and I'll be back next week with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.